We have three amazing webinars coming up at Renegade University. As always, go to renegadeuniversity.com to check out our new courses and events. So, in January and February, we have three courses all co-taught by me, but they will be Critical Race Theory with James Lindsay, Marx with Ben Burgess, and Blaxploitation with Kamasi Hill. So, go to renegadeuniversity.com, check out those upcoming webinars, our very large course catalog, and the new membership options. Again, go to renegadeuniversity.com, and I will see you in class. Thanks.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think.
Sometimes a podcast can be a work of art. This is my interview with Anna Kachian. I am joined from New York City, or I guess New York, by Anna Kachian of the Red Scare podcast. A lot of people know that I've been a huge fan of Anna's for a long time. Reference you a lot in my podcast and in my work generally. And I guess I've been thinking a lot about this interesting formation that's happened over the last 5 to 10 years, I guess, where it seems like the sort of cultural world, the intellectual world, political world has been bifurcated, right? Between liberalism, which you talk about a lot, and the rest of us. And the rest of us, though, include all sorts of odd players. I mean, you've had Steve Bannon on your show. You're a leftist of some sort. I'm an ex-leftist of some sort. There's libertarians around. There's trads around, paleocons in this sort of weird formation. Joe Rogan, whatever he is. I guess we're just all unified by what, like a revulsion against what we call the liberal regime? Is that, it's a very strange, I mean, it's the first time in American history where this kind of formation has happened, where you have the liberal regime being identified as such, which has been in formation for about 100 years, and being attacked by this very strange conglomeration of people. And I'm still trying to figure it out. I'm part of it, and you're part of it, but I don't exactly know what this is. I mean, this is what you and I talk about a lot, but it's still information in my mind.
Yeah, that's a lot to process. I'm scared. I thought you were going to ask me to define neoliberalism.
That's what I did with Jack.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, no.
And what did he say?
I mean, he doesn't really give a succinct definition, but it's... His definition, I guess the way he uses it, I like a lot. It's my favorite way in which people use it. It's just his description of the sort of dominant culture now. The way that things look in restaurants, right. The way that we order food, the way that we talk to each other, the way that we watch TV shows. Why were you scared that I was going to ask you to define neoliberalism?
Oh, because I watched the episode that you did with Dasha just to get a gist for the podcast, and you asked her, and I just like assume because we use that, we're very fast and loose with that term, but I guess that your question kind of is related to that in one way or another. I don't know how I'm going to even begin to answer that question, but our last episode was about a writer called Freddie DeBoer, who asked precisely this question in a post he wrote on Substack and a follow-up post he wrote to kind of clarify his points. And part of the reason we talked about those series of pieces is because he had used a picture of us on a shooting range with Alex Jones that we had put up to kind of promote our last episode before that. And his point, which was interesting, though I'm not sure I entirely agree with it, was that the so-called neoliberal consensus, the center is being basically beset by kind of a series of strange bedfellows of these arrayed forces that are kind of agents of chaos or nihilism, and who are winning the battle against, you know, social justice and leftism through a kind of what he calls like an id-based, like Jungian libidinal unheimlich appeal to kind of emotions and aesthetics. So they're not necessarily politically or ideologically coherent. They don't necessarily have a singular ethos. And we kind of got into his argument there, but it certainly, I think, feels that way. I think the easy mistake to make, and the mistake that Freddie makes, I think, even though, you know, he's a wonderful and talented writer and some of his broad assumptions are correct, is denying these kind of forces a political agency or a internal ethos. And I think it's very hard to have any sort of impact against the so-called neoliberal consensus in the way, you know, in a way that's kind of meaningful, that challenges it. And we can get into why that is, but, you know, you said that you're an anti-leftist and accused me of being a leftist, which I'm not and have never been. But I think, you know, we're all, in my mind, we're all liberals.
Okay.
And, you know, Freddie talks about kind of left-wingers, right-wingers, centrists, antique Marxists like himself. And at the end of the day, in my mind, we're all liberals. Anybody who has a Twitter account is a liberal.
Okay. I apologize for calling you a leftist. I thought that you used that term, maybe not, but there are certainly some areas of politics where your positions are essentially left, aren't they?
Yeah, of course.
And I mean, in economics, especially, you don't talk much about economics, but when you do, I mean, you sound sort of like a social democrat, democratic socialist, somewhere in there. Is that?
Yeah, fair? That's probably kind of a fair assessment of my and Dasha's kind of economic leanings.
Right. And so that's firmly left wing, isn't it? I mean, that's.
Yeah, in some sense, yes. So I do question, I mean, as a person who came from the Soviet Union, whose parents were completely traumatized and turned against communism, for instance, I do question some of the orthodoxies of democratic socialism, which, you know, I'm probably too stupid and scatterbrained to go into,
well,
like here in any meaningful fashion.
I mean, your primary interests are elsewhere. I mean, it's just economics is not your primary interest at all.
Yes. Right? Yeah, which is ironic because I actually have a degree in economics, which means nothing, but by the way, but
yeah. So you must have ever identify as a leftist?
I don't think so. And not because I have, you know, anything against the leftists, which I, you know, I do, of course, but not out of any sort of like revulsion or disgust or kind of identity based motivation. I never considered myself to be a political person, even though politics is kind of like a chief area of interest for me. Right. I've never considered myself anything really, like on a political spectrum.
But you must have been, when did you begin thinking about politics in a serious way?
I mean, that's hard to say. I think everybody began thinking about politics in a serious way around 2015, 2016. My dad was a very kind of politically interested guy. He would sort of like yell and brandish his fist at the TV. But I think for me, I would have to say it was the election of Barack Obama, because I remember distinctly where I was, and I was sort of hanging out in like a bar, and I was by myself, and I remember the crowd around me cheering, kind of like completely, like furiously, vehemently. And I remember thinking, like, this is going to be so bad. And it was something that was intuitive, you know, like I had no political knowledge acumen. And I think I felt, this was the second election of Barack Obama. The first one I felt much the same way, but I was, you know, still stuck in suburban New Jersey. But I remember, I think I felt how liberals and leftists must have felt when Donald Trump got elected.
Yeah, 2008 was the same moment for me. That election was the point of no return. That's when I realized that there was no place for me on the left, and certainly in liberalism, because of the, well, I mean, all the things, but the worship, the making of the Jesus figure, and the just the total immersion, I guess, in mysticism and romanticism and just all this emotional stuff. I guess what Freddie's talking about in his piece, right? That it was purely about like t-shirts and putting your kids in marches with signs, you know, with Obama's picture on it, and the infantilization of it that goes on there. It all became very clear in 2008 that I was done, and I felt profoundly alienated in 2008 because that's where I came from. I mean, my parents were socialists and I grew up among liberals and the whole thing, you know, bi-coastal elite, but that was the breaking point. And it's never changed. And in 2016 was, I guess, the next breaking point, when they completely abandoned any attempt to be fair or rational or even-handed in their dealings with Trump and his supporters. I loved what you had to say about Kyle Rittenhouse, the trial, that, and you and I see it, I think, exactly the same way, which is not just that it was absolutely outrageous how they framed Rittenhouse as a racist murderer, but more importantly, in a way, what you said, which is that I noticed, at least I hope, that it seems like this might be a turning point for a lot of people on the left, because it was so, so blatant that even people like Anna Kasparian on The Young Turks would publicly say, after denouncing Kyle Rittenhouse and all the, with all these lies for weeks and weeks, she finally did come out and say, yeah, it's not true that he was, you know, a murderer. So it's, that trial and all the surrounding discourse of it seemed to me to be so beyond the pale that I find it impossible to believe that any liberal or leftist could watch the evidence and all the surrounding discourse and not come away feeling totally ashamed.
Yeah, well, I think that's an interesting point, because I mean, the Kasparian thing was an incredible about face.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people were accusing her of like being conveniently careerist or opportunistic, but it does take some level of bravery to acknowledge to your hundreds of thousands of followers that you were wrong. And this goes back, I mean, for me, the Rittenhouse thing goes back to this kind of like neoliberal question. When I talk about something like neoliberalism, of course, on a policy level, I'm talking about privatization and austerity. And on a cultural level, I'm talking about a kind of permissiveness that looks like openness and freedom, but is actually homogenization and immiseration. And then on a material level, what this amounts to, and which is the crucial thing, I think, is this idea that, you know, your actual real economic choices and options are replaced by conveniences and amenities. And, you know, in other words, kind of the rebranding of austerity as opportunity. But what I noticed is I'm not really sure that the term neoliberalism is even the right term anymore, because what you have now, and Kyle Rittenhouse is an example of that, is this kind of like soft authoritarianism that I've called in the past empathy politics, which is kind of an appeal to morality, specifically in my mind, like this, you know, bourgeois moral sentimentalism.
Yeah.
I've seen other people refer to it as like trauma politics. You have like, you know, AOC crying on the House floor, or Elizabeth Holmes crying on the stand, or in general, Lemon leveraging, you know, claiming, disclosing their sexual assaults and sexual trauma in order to force certain political outcomes, like you saw with the Cuomo affair most recently. Mm-hmm. And of course, I've seen it referred to as trauma politics as well. I prefer empathy politics, because while trauma politics is, you know, much catchier, I think empathy politics is a better container term. And crucially, the main crucial point is that this kind of soft authoritarianism is not coming from the right. It's coming from leftists and liberals. Mm-hmm. And I think the Kyle Rittenhouse example is a crucial example, because you see in his case how entire swaths of the political class and the media commentariat were, you know, gamely led to believe that led to believe a completely like bogus narrative that had no bearing on reality, and which could have been, you know, easily dismantled if you had bothered to pay even minor attention to like the ample video evidence and mm-hmm. the court proceedings. Mm-hmm. And really what stands out is that there was no persuasion involved. Hmm. People just sort of just fell in line.
Mm-hmm.
You had, you know, Nina Turner, the Bernie endorsed candidate, mm-hmm. echoing something Cori Bush had said immediately after the Rittenhouse incident, that, you know, this white supremacist had drove across state lines armed with a weapon to terrorize the community. And I can't, I don't remember names now, but, you know, this is all searchable and documented. There was dozens of political figures coming out. It's almost like they had a keynote or a PowerPoint circulating with the talking points.
I know.
And, but, you know, sorry.
This thing just got me more than anything, just the bloodthirstiness of it. You know, a 17-year-old, I mean, even if he had done something wrong, like just that how merciless they were, ruthless toward this child. I mean, to frame him not just as a murderer, but as a racist murderer. And I mean, it just without even, now what's the motivation though? Why did they need to make him that in this case?
I think, you know, we live in a very racialized moment. Everything is race now. Everything was about sex, gender, you know, 4 years ago. Now everything is race, which I can get into. But the Rittenhouse thing reminded me of the Jussie Smollett case, where you also had dozens of political and media figures coming out, but to express support for Jussie Smollett,
right.
Even though he was clearly a bogus and staged incident that Dasha, by the way, called from the start.
Yeah.
and, you know, meanwhile, there were people like Bernie Sanders was coming out talking about Jussie Smollett as a brave man.
Oh, no.
And now, meanwhile, you know, you have this, I don't know how to pronounce it, but Waukesha, the Christmas parade, the guy who slammed into the Christmas parade.
I think it's Waukesha, I think.
Waukesha. Yeah. And that incident was swiftly memory-holed because the racial mm-hmm. optics didn't conveniently fit kind of the larger meta-narrative. But I think that this goes back to this question of, well, do we live in a neoliberal moment anymore or not? Because, you know, like I said, this kind of authoritarian ideological streak is basically being administered or like meted out by liberals and leftists. And it reminded me of this really kind of like super memorable line by a guy called Justin E.H. Smith. I don't know if you're familiar mm-hmm. with him.
Mm-hmm.
He's another guy on Substack.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, he was writing about the politicization of art. And he said something to the tune of like, well, in the Stalin days, you know, it's not that they wanted to violently snuff people out in prison basements. It's that it was the only means they had at their disposal. And I think now, with the internet and particularly social media, you have like two things at play. One is that it's much harder to get away with something like that fully, mm-hmm. As you saw with like the Khashoggi murder, for instance. I mean, nobody's gotten in trouble, but there is a mm-hmm. countless culture industry around it now, documentaries mm-hmm. and such. And two, that the users of these technologies are basically both more fickle and more pliant. So they're much more easily convinced, and they're much more easily incited into, you know, culture war.
Hmm.
No matter who you are, there are times when you want to search for something online that you wouldn't want others to know about. Now, I know most of you are probably thinking, why don't you just use incognito mode? But let me tell you, incognito mode, it turns out, does not hide your activity. It doesn't matter what mode you use or how many times you clear your browsing history, in fact. Your internet service provider can still see every single website you've ever visited. So that's why, even when I'm at home, I never go online without using ExpressVPN. It doesn't matter who your ISP is. ISPs in the US can legally sell your information to ad companies, but ExpressVPN is an app that reroutes your internet connection through their secure servers so your ISP can't see the sites you visit. ExpressVPN also keeps all of your information secure by encrypting 100% of your data with the most powerful encryption available. Most of the time, I don't even realize I have ExpressVPN on. It runs seamlessly in the background, and it's so easy to use. All you have to do is tap one button and you're protected. ExpressVPN is available on all your devices, phones, computers, even your smart TV. So there's no excuse for you to not be using it. So protect your online activity today with the VPN rated number one by CNET. Visit my exclusive link, expressvpn.com/unregistered, and you can get an extra 3 months free on a 1-year package. That's expressvpn.com/unregistered. expressvpn.com/unregistered to learn more. We haven't talked about class yet. And as you were talking, I mean, that immediately comes up. And I know you're very conscious of this. And this is where I hang out with a lot of libertarians, and they mm-hmm. tend to be deaf, dumb, and blind to class. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things I like about keeping connections with people on the left, because they're very aware of class. But the Rittenhouse case, again, seemed to me to be really fundamentally all about class from beginning to end. You know, you have the protection of, you know, a small store, basically like petty bourgeois property, right? Which is like sort of classic, you know, a working class thing to do in America. And, you know, protecting mm-hmm. that. And then the way that he was portrayed, and his mother especially was portrayed. I don't know if you saw that. I mean, that was.
Oh yeah. I was really fighting the urge to shitpost. I had my finger on the trigger.
Yeah. Putting pictures of her on Twitter, just as if this is self-evident that she's a racist piece of shit because of the way she looks. I mean, yeah. That, and constant, and with very just facilely, they didn't seem to have any compunctions about doing this to her or to him, but it was all about people in offices in New York City and Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles talking about this kid from Illinois, you know, who's, you know, clearly not of them. He's not of their ilk. Right. I mean, it just reeks of that. Do you know about Batya Ungar Sargon's new book? She was on the show recently. She makes this argument that it's basically the racial stuff, the wokeness really serves the class interests of the elite.
Yeah, it's right over there.
I figured, book, yeah. You must, right.
Yeah, I haven't read it yet. I haven't cracked it open, but it's an interesting premise. The stuff about Kyle's mother really pissed me off, because there was a bunch of kind of like lib femmes on Twitter being like, I'm 38 too, or like, I'm 40, I'm 2 years older, and this woman looks like this, implying that she was kind of like,
right.
Ugly and decrepit and stuff like that. And this woman to me looks like, you know, a classic woman you would see in the Soviet Union, kind of the great granddaughter of serfs. It was called Budlo, like a peasant class, prole woman. And I don't mean that in any sort of offensive way, but you know, this is a woman who has led a hard and troubled life, and mm-hmm. you know, as the details of the story trickled out, it turned out that this woman was a single mother, that she was having health problems, serious health problems. Kyle was working three jobs to support the family. And then it turned out that, in fact, she hadn't driven him to Kenosha at all, right?
Right.
And the other thing that was interesting about that is, you know, before the kind of facts became clear, I saw a lot of people asking, like, well, what kind of mother would, you know, transport mm-hmm. her child to a protest mm-hmm. and a kind of violent one at that, that was becoming a riot. And, you know, I had the thought as like, basically like a middle-class liberal coastal elite, I would never let my son go to
sure.
that sort of
me too.
event and, or gathering. And I said this to Dasha on the podcast, but what kind of mother allows her son to do that? Well, a working class single mother whose son is the man of the house.
Yeah.
Because there are no other men.
Yeah.
It's not up to her.
Right.
And the kind of mainstream reaction to Rittenhouse was so kind of cruel and id-based.
Uh-huh.
And it made me think of, you know, I think that there is kind of a deliberate, pragmatic, economic class element to these kind of grand mystifying meta narratives
mm-hmm.
about, you know, race and sex and gender in the United States. I also think that there's kind of a deeper psychological animus.
Yes.
I started reading Rene Girard finally after like 3 years of people pleading with me to do it because of the Rittenhouse case. And I'm sort of like now learning about his kind of ideas around like mimesis and scapegoating. But it's really something that we've said on the podcast that guys like Bernie Madoff and Harvey Weinstein, it's not that they were innocent, but they were certainly scapegoats
sure.
for the kind of larger ills or larger crimes of a deeper industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You go ahead.
No, you can, you know, somebody else put it to me really in a really hilarious way. You can even see Elizabeth Holmes like that
mm-hmm.
because tech CEOs do all sorts of kind of horrible shit on the down low, but Liz Holmes is kind of like the female girl boss scapegoat.
Oh, can you explain that for people who don't know the case?
Well, Elizabeth Holmes was, you know about this, I'm sure. Right?
I know a little, Holmes. I'm pretty sure I know who you're talking about.
Started. She was like she's like a gargantuan, like sunpaku-eyed blonde who modeled herself after Steve Jobs with the turtlenecks, right. And she started a company called Theranos that received, you know, $1 billion valuation, and on the basis of the new technology they were developing where you could prick your hand like you would with a diabetes mm-hmm. test and get all sorts of labs run so you could avoid kind of doing annoying lab work at the doctors and waiting for weeks. And it turned out the whole thing was fake and there was mm-hmm. no such technology. And they were sort of like kicking the can down the road. And now she's on trial. And her defense, I think part of their strategy is portraying her as kind of an abused and sexually harassed woman.
Mm-hmm. And therefore it's not her fault.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. She's not culpable because she's a woman. Is that right. That's what it boils down to, right? Because a man probably couldn't rely on that type of defense.
Right. Yeah. I mean, a man. Yeah. And I think like, you know, in the Rittenhouse case, there was a lot of like murmurs about how, you know, his self-defense case wouldn't stand and how it was going to be impossible for him to get a fair trial. And it's frankly like very galvanizing and hopeful that the American justice system persevered and did the right thing in this case.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And in addition, in the same week, they convicted Ahmaud Arbery's murderers, which also was the right decision, I think.
Yeah, it was a cascade of like these kind of mega trials. And those two together seem to confirm at least something positive and hopeful. But I was thinking about how interesting it was that now we're in the midst of, the Charlottesville trial, I think, is still going on. Rittenhouse and Arbery just closed. Ghislaine Maxwell is on the stand. But, I think all of this Rittenhouse stuff really kind of began with Me Too, which sounds like crazy Alex Jones conspiracy horseshit. But
do tell.
But, you know, which, of course, you know, Dasha and I couldn't have known at the start of our podcast when we began critiquing the movement. And I think probably part of the early success of our show has to do with the fact that we were kind of early and right about Me Too. But the thing that I saw right away and which bothered me the most about Me Too was not so much that this, like, you know, directionless airing of grievances in the form of a social justice campaign was like undignified or hysterical, but that it was, you know, as I've said before, a dress rehearsal for the erosion of due process in America. And this erosion would be undertaken on behalf of the elites, but in the name of the oppressed.
Yes. So that is some amazing jujitsu right there. Is there, you said there, you see a sea change, which is a big term with the Rittenhouse trial. I mean, do you see that? What's the evidence? We have Anna Kasparian, and I want to get back to the point you just made. It was amazing. But we have Anna Kasparian, who actually pretty much walked it back after she said something about, oh, but he's still a terrible guy and his mother's still terrible and it's terrible what he did. But, you know, it was still self-defense. You know, who else is there? I mean, is this going to change? Is it possible to pull people away from the cathedral and its mind control?
I just want to say that in that moment, I was very proud to be Armenian. Because I was like, you know, no matter how much we disagree, we always do the right thing in the end. I was rooting for Anna. Yeah, it was cool. I think like, what was the question? How do we get out of this?
Well, I mean, you said you predicted a sea change because of the Rittenhouse trial in the, I guess, on the left or among liberals in some way that a lot of people will see how outrageous the regime is in this and then turn against it. I certainly hope so. But why do you say that?
I just saw, I don't know. I mean, it's something that I felt very intuitively and I could be totally wrong, but I just felt kind of like a massive reckoning, even among some media figures who ordinarily would be hesitant, like Kasparian, to admit any kind of mistakes or any cracks in the narrative. And I think the way this changes is that we have to kind of try to imagine a world, a mode of political bargaining that goes beyond this new kind of post Me Too based empathy or trauma politic, where like the chief tactic, I think, is to lead with claims that are unfalsifiable and therefore fundamentally unassailable.
Yeah.
And you know, this goes for the instrumentalization of race, of sex and sex crime, of children, as we saw with the Alex Jones incident. I have been kind of privately thinking a lot about how to get past that. I think that we really need a new leadership class, but it's hard to say where they will come from.
A new leadership class?
Yeah, like, of people who are willing to not play dirty in that way, which sounds, I mean, to me, it sounds kind of utopian and idealistic.
And do you mean in government?
Yeah, in government.
Okay.
Probably not going to happen in media.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some people like that are being hailed as such, like Blake Masters and J.D. Vance. They're mainly coming from the conservative side. And they're big on like family values,
yep,
and patriotism and that sort of thing. And I don't know anything about JD. I know Blake a little bit. Hmm. I know I'm not getting paid by Peter Thiel, but I am not optimistic about it.
About what?
The kind of new wave of young conservative leaders.
Why?
Because I'm automatically kind of suspicious of any sort of establishment politics. I understand they're coming in a little bit from kind of fringe, from the outside. But I also find, I think at worst, I think the kind of family values, traditional patriotism thing feels like a LARP to me. It's sort of the other side of the AOC squad leftist LARP.
Hmm. How so? How's it LARPing? You think they're not genuine? You think J.D. Vance doesn't believe in family values and mom and dad and kids at home?
Well, I don't know what he personally privately believes, of course. And I think that his kind of intentions are pure, but I think I don't know if for me, the rhetoric is entirely convincing.
Okay. Well, so I was wondering what you thought of their platform, you know, mm-hmm. because so I study Steve Bannon, your friend, Steve Bannon, and the mm-hmm. MAGA movement every day. I watch it because I think it's just amazing to watch this social movement emerge in mm-hmm. real time, and a social movement that's on the verge, I think, of taking over at least the Republican Party.
Yeah.
But at least half of their politics are the opposite mm-hmm. of mine. I just like mm-hmm. them because they're taking down the cathedral. They're taking on right. the regime, and they're doing it most effectively. And they're winning like almost every day now against it. So I follow them for that reason. But my God, I don't want abortion to be illegal. Maybe you do. I don't want the 1776 project to determine what is taught in the schools. I don't want the borders closed. Maybe you do. But there's a lot there. But so I'm curious though about family values, because this is what I've been meaning to ask you for a long time, wanting to ask you. Mm-hmm. I think, isn't there more overlap between you and them on cultural stuff, especially family stuff, gender stuff, than there is with me? Don't you have some sympathy with sort of traditional conservative views on family?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't know what your
I'm like a hippie anarchist.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, full on, fuck it all. Gotcha. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I guess my chief sympathy with them is that I think that you should be able to raise a kind of typical nuclear family on a single income.
Yeah, right. That's Bannon's big thing, is you want to have that, the 1950s working class family, right? Where dad works and mom stays at home.
Yeah, and of course, I think like I'm more of a leftist in the sense that I don't care what form that family takes. Uh-huh. You know, I'm not like banging my gavel and saying that it has to be between a man and a woman and their biological children or anything okay. like that. But you know, you should be able to. I actually think, you know, it's not up to me. It doesn't matter what I personally think about kind of gender roles, for instance, mm-hmm. because we, for better or worse, whether you like it or not, and whether I like it or not, we are in the middle of a paradigm, a shift in gender roles.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, middle class women realistically are making more now than their male counterparts.
Yep.
So, you know, that's not up to me to stop. It's not really like my fight. But but I do agree that like, you know, you should be, my feeling about it is just, you know, strictly just like pragmatic observational one. There has to be a parent in the home to raise the children.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care which parent it is. I don't care if it's mom or dad mm-hmm. or, you know, because just I know from my own experience, the idea that you can get the same result by hiring help or sending your kids, you know, to some daycare, which they're doing now, you know, at like 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, is not going to yield the same result.
Mm-hmm. Sure, fair, but I thought that you were more sympathetic to traditional views on family. you do believe that gender is biologically determined to some extent, don't you?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, not of course, because, I mean, the entire academic world disagrees with that, right?
I can never... I always forget which one is real and which one is fake.
I know,
race,
me too.
Or gender. I'm like literally, my mind is spinning right now.
Okay. So, I mean, well, no, gender is a social construct, right? This is like the oldest thing we've been hearing about from academia for what, 50 years now. You toss that out, right? I mean, you don't.
Well, sex or gender. I mean.
Oh, sorry. Sex versus gender.
I can't. This is a very confusing conversation.
Let's do it. Okay. So, I mean, the way that it's talked about in classrooms, right, is that sex. Well, some people say sex is biological and gender is a social construct.
Right.
Which that's the easiest way to get this across to most people, because most people can sort of see that sex is your genitals, right? And then gender is what you want to do and what do you want to wear, like whether you want to wear a dress or not, right? So I'm, as I said, I'm completely radical out there. I think it's all a social construct, but that's what I think most people who go at this come away with it thinking that there's two things. Sex is biological and real and you can't change it, but gender is totally fluid and amorphous.
Wait, you're saying, you think that sex is a social construct?
I mean, I think the word is a construct. I think the concept is a construct. I think the way that we change the construct is a construct, you know, so yeah. But I mean, I've heard you many times kind of say things that sound like what we call gender essentialism.
Uh-huh.
There's nothing wrong with that. I'm just curious about your point of view on that. And why, I mean, you must, because you were in academia, you were a grad student. Must have been, and you were in art history, right? Which must have been full of people, of feminists who think that gender is a social construct, right?
But no, well, crucially, I was in academia, kind of like my girlfriends and I, who, you know, still keep in touch from grad school, always laugh that we were like the last kind of class before the kind of bottom totally like fell out from, and academia became...
Right.
Just like a total commerce industry. I mean, it was definitely heading there. I'm not delusional, but I remember literally coming back to grad school after my first year to do my second year toward the master's. I was a PhD student. I didn't flunk out Freudian slip. I dropped out. I spiritually flunked out because I'm an underachiever. But I remember like just the population had like tripled of grad students. There was like way too many of them and they all looked really young and really kind of goofy. And I realized they were master's students who they were like bleeding to pay for our,
that's right.
Stipends.
That's right. Where was this? Where'd you go?
I went to the Institute of Fine Arts at New York University.
Oh, at NYU.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That world and New York City in general, and the sort of the world you come from, or at least, well, that world that you come from is full of people who believe that, or at least they say they believe that gender is a social construct. So you must have been at odds. Did you deal with that concept when you were in grad school at all?
I like really kept my head down and tried to like not hang out with any of my classmates. And also like I've personally, like I live in like kind of like the ground zero for like libtardation, but I've like personally, I rarely interact with those people.
you don't talk to people around you in New York.
No, I mean, now I don't, even more so because I'm a mom and I just like stay indoors, like white Sharia style. But like all of my friends who are like artists and creatives are basically conservative. I mean, not actually, but here they would count.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, I live in Berkeley, so I don't talk to anybody either. I know exactly what you're going through. But I guess I'm just, and I don't want to have an argument about it. I'm just curious if you've thought about this, and I guess not much, but you do have, I mean, that is your position though, right? That some things in you biologically determine that you are a woman. Some things that you do, some things, the ways you behave or think or act or whatever, where you believe that some of that's was biologically determined.
Yeah, like for example, right now I won't have an argument with you because I'm like socially conciliatory and amenable and I hate conflict.
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
And like just I'm very tentative because it freaks me out to stake a claim and people will say, like, oh, that's because you're a crypto fascist and you don't want to say what you mean. And it's like, no, I'm just like, I'm a girl and I hate making people mad and I hate fighting with people. No, but I think like since I've had the kid, it's like really been driven home because, you know, I see some of my friends who have, I have a boy, I see some of my friends who have girls. It's just like the girls and boys are different.
Yeah. Okay.
My kid immediately from, in fact, in the womb, but definitely from birth, had an impulse to like what Bap calls master space and like explore, like propel himself forward and destroy stuff. And meanwhile, my friends who have girls, the girls are kind of like very thoughtful and introspective, docile, verbal. They don't have such a profound and like immediate, like urgent desire to destroy. Also boys eat way more than girls.
Yep.
And like your breast milk is different depending on whether you're, you know, nursing a boy or a girl.
Oh, I didn't know that. Huh.
Yeah. Like the kind of protein content of it. It's crazy. Like all this kind of.
You're going to love, I don't know if you know this. Do you know about Judith Butler's child? Do you know about this? And
no.
Judith Butler and Wendy Brown had a child. And after that, and for those who don't know, Judith Butler basically invented all this stuff about gender being a social construct. She's like the queen of postmodernism. After they had a kid, or maybe it was two kids, they were like, you know, they said this publicly. They said, you know what? All that stuff about gender being a social construct is bullshit. They don't observing their own, it's what you're saying. They themselves, of all people, agreed with you. After seeing their own children behave, they said, oh yeah, no, that's all biologically determined.
Well, I mean, okay, but that's the thing. I think a lot of I literally, like, I've been taking weed gummies recently because, you know, I'm finally in a space where I'm like getting my mind back and I want to like activate it or whatever. And I took one the other day and I was sitting back and thinking like, wow, it's literally so crazy that Susan Sontag got pregnant and gave birth to a child.
Why?
Because she's such a kind of like philosophical lesbian. She's such a kind of strong masculine woman.
Yeah.
I think that gets to the heart of the matter, because a lot of the people who say like, oh, like sex isn't real or gender is a social construct. I do believe gender is a social construct to some extent, for sure. Are people who, you know, have Peter Pan syndrome and they're like just inexperienced and don't know what they're talking about. And, you know, up until recently, I was one of them. And people always get mad at me. They're like, oh, Anna's doing her as a mother shtick now. Because now that she has a kid, she's you know, putting herself on a pedestal and speaking with some kind of moral authority. And it's like, well, yeah, I am, because literally having a kid changes your whole mind. It rewires your chemistry and makes you think things.
Yeah.
I mean, do you have kids?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, so there you go. Yes. And it's not that I'm trying to like finger wag at anybody, but I'm just saying like, you know, you have to have the kind of humility to acknowledge that there are certain things that you just don't know.
Mm-hmm. It's, I have to say, it's interesting. It's been interesting listening to the two of you talk since the birth of your son, because Dasha does not have a kid and Dasha's younger than you. And she clearly doesn't have any of that experience. And I think it's been interesting to sort of listen to you sort of navigate that. But it's, you know, I would imagine, it's fundamental. I mean, it changes everything in your life forever.
Yeah. Dasha's really great with the kid. I think she's like a natural mother.
Yeah.
It's very cute. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Huh.
Does she want kids?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know that. Has she talked about that on the show?
I think so. I mean, like sparingly. I also like, we don't have to talk about this now, because I recognize also to most people, this is like deeply boring. But I guess what I'm interested in is like how having a child and observing the child actually gives you insights into kind of the broader world of adult humans whose impulses and desires are really not that much different. Like everybody basically wants to be swaddled, which is why they have those weighted anxiety blankets, you know?
Mm-hmm. Have you ever tried one of those?
No.
I'm
scared.
I had a panic attack immediately.
Yeah.
I couldn't stand it.
How heavy is it?
I think it was like 20 or 30 pounds. It's terrible.
Oh no. Yeah.
It's terrible. Don't do it. You were just in Austin.
Yes.
And a famous picture of you with Alex Jones and Dasha mm-hmm. out there. That's, I guess I started this interview by talking about this, you know, the strange bedfellows things. And here's my Alex Jones history. Okay. I had never watched or listened to him in any serious way until about 6 months ago, maybe. And mm-hmm. finally I just did. I just sat down and listened. I think it was one of his Joe Rogan appearances.
Right.
And he's just spewing facts and information, most of which I'd never heard, all of which was amazing. And I went and checked mm-hmm. all of it. I fact checked all of it rigorously, and it was all correct.
Okay.
It was amazing. For like 3 hours, he's just talking and talking and talking. And it's all, and I thought, now what does this mean about me? I don't know. And what do I do with this information that Alex Jones is right about everything, or seemingly? What do you make of him, first of all, and that phenomenon?
You mean his like,
well, just
mental state or mental ability?
What does it mean that someone like me had never encountered him in any serious way? And then when I did, I found out that I don't know a bunch of stuff that I should have known. I mean, and I represent, I'm sure, thousands and thousands of people who should know all this stuff, but don't.
I think that just means he was probably deplatformed. I think he has kind of like an almost schizophrenic mind that doesn't filter out minutia and details that most of us need to filter out to get by, and as such he's completely addled. I said on our podcast, you know, like if you meet him, he's very charming and personable,
mm-hmm.
but like all kind of insanely famous people, he's very much in his head and sort of like looks past people into some kind of like, I don't know, liminal space. But in the baseline, you know, on a baseline sense, his charmingness and personability is like a manipulation. Like he's literally selling himself. And I don't think it's because he has any arch political agenda. I think that he's a guy who really wants to be liked, but has a difficulty with actually connecting. He has like an almost childish narcissism.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's kind of a ham and a show off.
Right.
And, you know, I think for someone who's basically interested only in hearing himself, and I don't mean that actually in any mean or negative way. Mm-hmm. He's just kind of like self-sustaining, like powered by his own addled mind. He's mastered like a very important skill, which is agreeing with people and at least pretending to absorb their criticisms. Which is, you know, very impressive. It puts people at ease and makes them feel like they're having a conversation. On my podcast, I called him a salesman, and I didn't mean it in like an exactly flattering way. But I think like most people probably have an impression of him as being like angry and deranged, and he's mm-hmm. really not that.
Right. Right. That's an amazing psychoanalysis of Alex Jones. I've never heard anything like that. The politics of him, why were you attracted to him? I missed the backstory of why you went to Austin.
I just think he's hot.
Oh,
I'm
really?
Just attracted to him. I'm kidding. I'm not kidding. Dasha and I both think he's kind of cute.
Really?
Yeah. When like a kind of a disheveled and overweight, formerly buff older man. But no, I mean, I don't think of him as a political person foremost. I don't think of him as like a pundit or a critic. I think of him as an artist.
Oh, wow.
I mean, he is. I know that sounds kind of like pretentious or whatever, but he is like he's similar to somebody like Hedo Stierle or something.
Who's that?
Or even Adam Curtis. They're sort of Hedo is a kind of documentary art filmmaker leaves also these elaborate connections between events.
What makes it art? InfoWars.
That's a good question.
You know, by the way, Jack the Perfume Nationalist told me that your podcast was the first art podcast. And I'm not sure what that means. Do you have any sense why you do art?
That's a good question. Jack is really sweet and I'm flattered, but I don't think we're like a political podcast, but I think we're sort of like squarely in the realm of cultural commentary. I think maybe because we weren't, you know, strictly interested in conveying information, like, you know, these dreary and strict kind of NPR podcasts are like, hello, it's Anna. Hi, mm-hmm. I'm Dasha. And we're working. But creating kind of like a collage, like an aesthetic collage of affect and kind of emotivity. It's funny because, you know, like Dasha is a working actress and a filmmaker now. And I'm sort of like a writer or a critic, but I think like all women have experienced myself as an actress too. Like I'm an actress in some sense, like a bullshit actress or whatever, but like everyone is sort of like acting a part. There's a line by Vladislav Surkov that I really like about women acting. And he says that kind of the problem with women is that they're all actresses and they're all trying to kind of imprint their image.
Hmm.
On the world.
Well, but wait a second. I mean, so the performance, if you can even call it a performance of Red Scare, is almost like anti-performance, isn't it?
That it's lo-fi and low effort.
Yeah, which is what you guys call it. Right? I mean, was that deliberate or is it just what you felt like doing?
No, I think we just very naturally like fell into our roles.
Yeah.
We didn't have like a meeting about it or anything. Yeah.
Right. We want to have an anti-performance aesthetic that never came up.
I think if I was to give a relatively harsh criticism of me and of us and of what we do, is that like all women, we maintain plausible deniability.
Meaning what?
Well, the kind of lo-fi, low effort aesthetic, I think defends us, makes us less vulnerable to having to defend any of our claims, right? in the court of public opinion or whatever. Though, I mean, we're asked to do it, of course, but not something that I am not, you know, I like kind of the background of the podcast and I don't want to change it ever, but that's something that I'm personally very like conscious of. But I think like now it's very interesting because I think, you know, right wingers are very fond of saying that we live in like effeminized or emasculated culture. But I do think that there's some truth to that because everybody now is in the business of maintaining plausible deniability.
Okay. So that's going to sound strange to a lot of people because I'm quite sure that most people who know about you think about you as just an extremely smart person. Like that's why you're known.
That's not true.
No, I mean, certainly your fans, I mean, everybody who listens to the show is going to think of you that way. They don't listen to you because you're dumb girls. Like, come on. I mean, it's an intellectual show.
The consensus is that we're literally retards and they're not wrong, by the way.
Hold on now. Who's consensus among whom?
Our fans, our listeners.
They think you're retards?
Yeah, they think we're their retards though. So they love us.
You can't be serious.
No, I'm serious. That's the thing that's like kind of like a centerpiece of people's like parasocial engagement with the show.
They think you're stupid?
Yeah.
And they listen to you because you're stupid?
No, I think they listen to us because we have, as far as women are concerned, we have like relatively soothing voices and we like smoke cigarettes. There's like an ASMR element. We say some zany stuff.
Okay. Is extreme humility a Russian trait? Is that a thing?
I don't think it's extreme humility. I think it's something far worse, which is also kind of avoiding identifying yourself.
Okay. I mean, every week you hold forth on the topics of the day with very high level sophisticated analyses that...
Yeah.
I mean, what is that if not like... a political intellectual podcast of a high caliber. I don't see what else to call it. How is it stupid and retarded?
Well, I think it is on some level. Well, first of all, I think you have to be like really stupid and retarded to even put yourself out there.
True.
In the way that we do.
Right. Yes.
Like I'm a profoundly like, this is not false humility. This is like totally like dead ass true. I am a fundamentally naive and stupid person because I say things that I assume will kind of like register with people that they'll understand. And don't explain myself, and then they get angry, and then it looks like I'm kind of like trolling or being, you know, cruel or something.
Is it that you make statements about which you are not fully informed? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, or I make statements that are not, you know, apparent to people. Like, I don't think it would occur to people, most people, even though it makes perfect sense to me. How something like Me Too, which most people would regard understandably, and this is like a positive thing in a positive light, how something like Me Too could lead to like an erosion of due process and civil liberties, how it could lead, how there's a straight shot, there's a direct line to me from believe women to believe science.
Oh, okay.
It's the same process.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, yes, yes. Okay. Yes.
And once, you know, one thing is out of the way, they move on to, you know, greener pastures.
Right. Okay. I just want to say, I mean, I don't know. I think people calling yourself stupid just makes no sense to me. And it has to be something else going on there. I mean, I guess that's what you're saying. There is something else going on there, but
I do feel stupid because like you think about like my father was a genius.
Mathematician, right?
Yeah, he was, you know, a world-class mathematician.
Right.
And not only that, but he was like incredibly well-read and well-informed in like, in terms of like music, literature, art. My mom's an even bigger genius than my dad. And really? I think she's unrecognized because she's been a housewife her whole life.
Wow.
And I think people think my dad's a genius, but really my mom is the genius of the family. But like, I think like I'm a kind of stunted and cheap facsimile of my parents for sure. with the trade-off that I'm much more well-adjusted.
Okay.
And much less underachieving, even though I'm still an underachiever, but I've figured out how to monetize certain, you know, shreds of their personality at great expense to myself.
Okay. I'll just let that stand. I mean, if you want to call yourself that, fine. I mean, I think most people that listen to you would think it's ridiculous, but I mean, what is it that you do? Is it lack of knowledge about certain things that leads you to believe this about yourself? Or is it, you say you're naive? How are you naive? And it, like, that's the last thing I would call you.
I mean, I think Dasha and I are both like kind of earnest and enthusiastic and naive about certain things.
Okay. Okay. That's not at all how you, how I think you're perceived by most people, but
again, like as my mother always says, you know, you should never correct a mistake in your favor, and I think it's better to be perceived as like an icy bitch.
Is that what you're going for, the icy bitch?
No, I don't know.
Do you get called
enough
that?
About me.
Do you get called that?
Yeah, but it's not so bad. I understand. We have like resting bitch face.
Right. Okay. So I want to finish by going back to your really amazing argument that I've heard you develop over a couple of years now, but about Me Too being, you called it a dress rehearsal for the erosion of, or the, what'd you call it exactly? A dress rehearsal for what?
For the erosion of due process.
Due process. Yeah.
Yeah.
So like, the way you're talking about all these sort of liberal initiatives and movements and cultural formations, it sounds like, and I am not disagreeing with you, it sounds like you believe that they're motivated to introduce more and more authoritarianism, period. That it's an authoritarian mission that the Democratic Party and liberals are on.
Yeah, just want to preface that by saying, I'm not implying that it's kind of a party-wide collusion or conspiracy. I do think that these things are, you know, decentralized, though people kind of march in lockstep with one another. But yeah, I think that there's probably like a move to less civil liberty, less due process happening as we speak.
So what are, I mean, there's a lot of Democrats and a lot of liberals in this country, you know, and is that what Bernie Sanders is about? Is that what Elizabeth Warren is about? Is that what, I mean, they want more and more control and less freedom? Is that what they're, what's driving these people?
I think probably Warren, yes. Bernie probably is kind of laboring under the delusion that that's not what he wants, but he's been kind of useful to advancing those goals.
Right, right, right. Well, thank you for this. And I hear the boy in the background, so I will let you go. But I appreciate you coming on the show, and everyone should go listen to the Red Scare podcast, because it's the most brilliant political podcast, certainly one of them out there. And I'm a huge fan and I love it. And thank you for doing it.
That's really sweet of you. Thank you.
Thank
you. I'm very suspicious of compliments.
I figured you would be.
Yeah,
I figured you'd hate it. Yeah. What do you think is the
alternative? No, but I really.
What do you think I'm trying to do?
No, nothing. I think like most compliments are fairly innocent. I'm just like, it's a bad reflexive quality.
Yeah.
But I feel like the opposite roasting also gets you a long way, because it's almost much more flattering to bother to learn enough, observe enough about another person's character to accurately mock them.
True.
Yeah.
Indeed. Yeah. Mockery is the highest form of flattery or something. Is that it?
Yeah. I thought it was imitation, but I actually agree with you on that.
Yeah. Right. Interesting. Yeah. All right, Anna. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I am Thaddeus Russell. To become a member of the Unregistered Underground Supporting Listeners Group, go to patreon.com/unregistered.